far as I know, I think Don might join us late. He said he would, and I haven't heard anything since. But let's go ahead and get started. Paul's on the phone right now. Renata, Dave, Katya, Laura, and Kevin are all in the room, and staff is present as well. Hope everybody got a good night's sleep, indeed. Before we kind of get started going over the materials, a couple things. Well, one, I know Dave needs to leave early today, so but I think he'd said, you know, to the extent there's a preference for dealing with something first while it's here, maybe sex offenses, but, like, you know, we have, again, basically kind of this month and the December meeting before, you know, the written comments are due on this next batch. So space things out, you know, again, kind of say we're always happy to meet the folks, you know, individually to talk through things. If that's helpful, let us know. Try to give us, you know, with two holidays coming up.
And a number of birthdays.
And apparently a number of birthdays.
Three at least. Mm-hmm.
Which I should note.
Yes, you should. How do you not know this? We've been spending years together by now.
Maybe my... I rely on my assistants. My assistants. I got nothing here.
Russian hacking, is that what you're
going to do? Yeah, well, exactly. It's the... right, so given that, give us some lead time if you want to set up a meeting, like even set it up now for, like, say, the first week of December, great. I'm happy to have a sit down. Just let us know. A few other things, kind of big picture. So I've been putting together, because we have, district agencies, it's like you have to start getting together budget documents and all of these things together. And as part of that, I've been kind of mapping out more sequence of the additional offenses that we'll be looking at. And I'm happy to talk details about that, you know, offline or send you kind of like where the latest thinking is. But, and I mentioned this a bit before, but, you know, bottom line, come December, after you all have the comments come in on this current package, we're going to submit another relatively, certainly not the same size, more small to medium size package of recommendations. A bit of a mishmash of things that will, again, kind of come out late December, go to the end of January, maybe early February, depending on how big this is, how much time we need to give y'all. And then after that, what we're plan to have ready for you is, again, like a big across-the-board update, right? That's going to, like, you know, the comments we've received at various points, you know, hey, here's how, where we've incorporated it, where we haven't, you know, kind of goes through all of these things and gives, like, an updated version, right? So property offenses. Offenses against persons, you know, general provisions. And so that'll be a big kind of like kind of a review, right? You know, it's an update, but it's going to be one that kind of runs across the spectrum. And we'll give plenty of time for you all to review that. And so again, that'll come out end of January or February. And then after that, for the remainder of the year, the really big things are drug offenses, weapon offenses, and penalties. And, you know, that's big. In some sense, it's more straightforward, right? You know, there are definitely, you know, difficult issues everywhere, but at least with weapons and drugs, the actus reus is usually very simple on a lot of them. And so that should make that aspect of it at least cleaner and simpler. That's the general lay of the land. Beyond that, kind of, you know, depends on how many resources and what kind of mandate the council and the mayor want to kind of continue to provide for us as to, like, how much further we get down the road. And again, happy to kind of go over some details later if folks are interested. But one other kind of key aspect, and it's a change from kind of where we started a couple years ago. And I've talked about before, and you'll see it when we do our update, we're going to rebrand things. Instead of it being a Title 22A, we're going to mark it a 22E. Y-E. Just because E for enacted. So the thought is, you know, when we started out, the thought was, we don't know how much we're going to do. So the idea was, all the reform stuff goes in a new 22A, and the leftovers stay in 22. But we also had, as you might recall, we had the what was sometimes called the Enactment Plus impact. We're also supposed to be enacting Title 22 as part of our mandate. It has all the, you know, those little details that are, you know, we have to kind of painstakingly go through. So the idea is, instead, what we should be aiming for is a enacted Title 22, and then there will be, because now it's like we'll be covering the bulk of that, and then the leftover bits will either be in like a, it might be too confusing, but now in the in an ejected 22A, or
ejected starts with E.
It does. E. Huh.
So it's confusing.
So more confusion into things. Or we leave it in the enacted 22A, but specifically exempt those remaining offenses from the general provisions and everything else. Essentially, they would verbatim be brought over into the enacted title as is and insulated with an explicit provision saying, you know, the general provisions don't apply to this. So something like, for instance, animal cruelty, which I have in the sequence put at the back end, very back end, kind of our to-do list. You know, we may very well not get to that. As we put together our compilation for a enacted Title 22 or Title 22E, we'd have the general part, as we've been working on, a lot of the core stuff, you know, offenses against persons and property, all the revised versions, the general part would apply to that, new everything. But then there are going to be some pockets, like for animal cruelty, would still be in the Title 22E, it would be part of the enacted thing, with its exact same language, with an added proviso that, you know, again, notwithstanding any other provision, you know, the general part does not apply. So in other words, we don't, what we want to avoid is, this is what happens in the federal back and forth about mens rea reform, what they talk about there. You know, like, we don't want to, like, have a, put out these new general part rules with all sorts of implications and then unthinkingly apply it to some of these existing offenses, because we don't know what that would mean, right? Like, if you just took the animal cruelty language as is and just magically waved a wand and said the general part applies to this, that's a mess. You know, I don't even know, like, nobody, that's just a illogical way to do it. So we'll make clear that anything that's brought over unreformed into the proposed Title 22E is insulated from the general part. So that's the kind of a little bit of a mindset shift, but it's not substantive in the sense. This is kind of organizational as to how the package of recommendations goes forward to the council. Yeah, Dave?
Yeah, because the reason I got in my head, and maybe just in my head, and nowhere else did it exist, that we were going to try to enact the existing code first.
Yeah.
So that 22 becomes enacted.
That's right.
And then we simply, and then once it's enacted, then it's easy to delete and,
that's
and
right.
make changes to the enacted code as a step two.
That is, you are correct that we had been thinking that way. I too had been thinking that way. We put together, you know, a package to enact Title 22, right? We did this a while back. Hasn't gone anywhere. It is still thinkable that, like, that sequencing could, the council could choose to, like, pick things up and move it that way. That kind of two-step.
You see, enacting should be non-controversial.
Oh, absolutely.
There's
absolutely.
No change to it.
Absolutely.
It simply makes everything easier to deal with for the rest of the project.
I agree. Well, for everything in the future. That's why they want the enactment to happen, right?
That's right.
So the question is just like, right, whether to do a two-step or to just merge the two into one. That is, I think, ultimately a back-end legislative decision.
The reason that I think it's better to do the other one is once it's enacted, then for the council to do its business for however long it's going to take to have hearings on the work that we're substantively doing, the council may want to make changes to Title 22. It's not like they're stopping now while we're doing this procedure.
Sure.
It would just be easier for them to do that while the rest of the process goes on.
Yeah.
I don't know.
That is definitely one approach. Anyway, so you know, that was kind of what we'd initially thought. And you know, we continue to work with our partners in the council and you know, to optimize whatever it is. Substantively, again, we can do it either way. Either way, the enactment work has to get done, and it largely has been done, although we'd have to update it. And either way, we're putting together the new statutory language. So it's the procedural mechanism and the timing on how they want to move with pieces of this. Do we want to do it all together, move it forward, break it up? Break it up into more parts. I don't, you know, ultimately we want to be as helpful as we can on that regard, and definitely arguments can be made different ways. But in terms of, like, I also, like, the thing to emphasize maybe is, again, how much we're covering, okay? So by kind of my looking at kind of some of the statistics for recent years, we've already covered have first drafts out, have comments from you all, or at least imminently we'll have comments back from those offenses that constitute a majority of convictions, total, you know, felony and misdemeanor in the district. By the end of this fiscal year, so by, you know, the end of September, that number jumps up, I think, to like 80-some%. Of all convictions for misdemeanors and felonies, we will have developed at least first drafts and hopefully be far along, almost final at that point, you know, or closing in on it for the recommendations of the underlying offenses for, again, over 80%. We get a little bit further, we get up to 95%, you know, into the next. So it's, we're really, you know, there's a ton of other stuff, both in Title 22, I mean, gambling alone, there are like 20 different, you know, statutory sections on gambling.
Which is currently subject to a lot of ongoing council review. Like, there's pending legislation about gambling in light of the new Supreme Court opinion. So that's going to be kind of a moving
exactly.
target.
Exactly. And like, there are other things too, from, you know, a number of discrete misdemeanors that are out there, you know, fare evasion, right? You know, there's a number of things which maybe there's council action on in the interim, maybe cleans up some of this, but like, there's still a fair bit out there. And even outside of Title 22, oh my goodness, right? You know, there are hundreds of these regulatory type misdemeanors. Those are off the, they're off of our radar in the sense that they're not charged, there aren't convictions. You know, maybe we could get to that down the road, but they're not a priority. So anyway, I'm happy to kind of talk more details about what our kind of pitch is for kind of a sequence of things. But in terms of a frame shift and kind of how you'll see things presented, when we come out in, you know, February with a kind of a January, February with this big update, we're going to kind of rebrand it as, hey, here's what the new enacted Title 22 looks like. And again, there'll be pockets of old stuff in there that are going to be untouched. But it's going to mainly try to get everybody in the mindset of, here's what it's really going to look like, right? You know, it's not an additional thing that then we'll have to reintegrate. Instead, it's all together.
Richard, is there a...
Yeah.
You mentioned which offenses it will cover in terms of current charging.
Yeah.
Is there a single large category? What's the single largest category that remains?
After weapons and drugs... in terms of like what it accounts for, the single biggest section is the kind of Title 23 failure to appear, which is, you know, it's like 5% or something of all convictions.
And maybe animal cruelty.
I'm sorry?
And maybe animal cruelty.
After that, those kinds of Title 23 ones, there are a few big, you know, there's POCA, you know, possession of a container of alcohol. There's like prostitution, some big misdemeanors that have like a lot of convictions. There are a number in Title 50, fleeing, some other things, which, again, all of these we may be able to chip at away at sooner, but, you know, the big punch, though, I would say, like, for the only felonies that are going to be left, the only big group of felonies left after, you know, this summer, that we will not have addressed really are obstruction of justice type felonies. And they are, again, myriad in forms. The actual obstruction of justice statute, of course, itself has like eight alternative means, right, all sandwiched in there. But I'm including in obstruction of justice, you know, bribery, public corruption. There are a number of kind of more tangential ones, which are, you know, false personation of a law enforcement officer, which is really, I think we'll go in the chapter for obstruction of justice, right? Like, you know, the harm that's going on. Anyway, so there's a big set of those type offenses, mostly felonies, some of them very serious felonies, which are still going to be left. In terms of how much they account for actual convictions, it's small, right? Like, these, while they're important and, severe offenses, they don't actually account for much in terms of statistics and what's going on. So that's kind of one of the things we're left for to address, hopefully, this fall, or next fall, I should say. There's a last mile problem that we faced, right? Of we get diminishing returns in terms of new offenses. They're often rarely charged and or, you know, convicted, and they tend to also be more and more misdemeanors are what's left. So that's, you know, and again, how much we keep working on that, I don't know. The exact timing on, you know, these things. Definitely want to work with council in terms of prioritizing this. I'm happy to send out some information about this or talk with people, after the meeting. But I just want to put that out there that, you know, we're thinking about this. And in terms of what you'll see, no changes right now, but come that February package, again, like the kind of the framing of it will be a little bit different in terms of, you know, that's the 22 enacted version, and start to think about it that way. Doesn't say we can't go back to the like two-step enact and then go to this form. This really comes down to like how recommendations are picked up and moved, and that's a ways down the road. And any other questions kind of on that organizational planning front? And if not, a couple other things to mention. Just our next meeting is going to be December 5th. We are also meeting the day after New Year's on January 2nd is the first Wednesday of the month. Just putting that out there. And I get disbelieving stares, perhaps, from some directions. But,
look was not disbelief.
Oh, disbelief.
It was a look, but it disbelief.
Second. So when the way the calendar works this year, New Year's Day is a Tuesday, so you have the weekend, that awkward New Year's Eve day on a Monday. New Year's Eve is on a Monday. Ugh. And then you got Tuesday off for New Year's Day, and then Wednesday, back in the saddle, here at the meeting at 10 a.m.
That may be a phone
call. Just putting that on your radar.
That may be a phone call.
See if the phones work.
Exactly. Exactly.
Richard, I like how you're trying to use the awkwardness of New Year's Eve Monday to, like, manually just place the awkwardness in the first meeting of the year.
Yes. Well,
or you could move the meeting. Or, I mean, it's also like you actually have a number of Wednesdays to choose from. That like
go
really,
figure. Go figure. Well, so this is our default.
It's like a Wednesday heavy month.
I will say it has especially
Rich,
more Wednesdays.
Rich with one day. Yeah. Well,
there's five of them.
Yeah, five.
There's many to choose from.
So here's the topic. The main topic will be at that point the. We will have received the written comments, right, that came in December. So it's more talking through what was received then. That'll be, so it's not going to be new material at that point that I expect to discuss. I think it'll be, you know, reviewing comments on that.
And no, you're making a mistake.
The telephone.
Because the comments
really
began and turned in on the 21st, also known as, like, well, just before major holiday.
Wait,
the 19th.
I thought they were the
19th. 19th, whatever, still. And then, okay. Really?
Yeah.
To turn it on a Wednesday?
No, that's a Friday.
No, it's
I can
not.
Double check that. You know,
stalking,
anyway. It,
stalking one is
I will double check it, and we can go with the more generous between those two. If it is, you know, if it's the 21st, we will. If there's a documented support for the 21st other than a bare assertion, we will go with the 21st. Exactly. Either way, give a little cushion.
Yeah, the 21st is a Friday. Yeah. You do have the 19th written down here. That's crazy. Because the 21st is the Friday.
Okay. Well, I will double check the email and make sure if I communicated. But, like, you know, if it needs to be the 21st, I will double check that, okay, and get back to everybody to confirm.
In any case, it's right before people might be, and then right, yeah. Who's going to read the comments?
Who's going to read the comments?
I mean,
yeah, I. So if
I mean, I've done my reading for today. I will probably read the comments. I just want the others to have a chance. Just
say.
Good. Well, if
I'm flattered
if the
by your
second
concern,
Wednesday right. works for folks. I could go out on a limb and, you know, see. But if I mean, I can try to float, you know, one of the following Wednesdays. I think somebody had a recurring second Wednesday issue, actually. But if I'm wrong about that or if schedules have changed, great. I think if it doesn't work for anybody to move it, we should keep it where it is because this is our normal default time. So I will send an email out inquiring. If there are no concerns, but like to the extent people can access, people present now can access their calendars and look at that second Wednesday, which would be the 9th of January. If that morning looks available, looks great, looks yes, clear eyed and not so blurry eyed.
That should work for me.
Great. All right.
There's immediate feedback.
Oh, I like the 9th.
I really like the 9th. Excellent. We're not possible at this point.
I'm sorry.
We thought you were looking at
your dad. Yeah, it looked like it. She's deep, like, you know,
something else.
There's
like a flood of things washing through. Moving the January 2nd meeting to January 9th.
I already had it as January 9th, which means I think that you must have thought it was January
9th. I must have. I don't know about some
wishful thinking from my colleagues on the side of the table.
Yeah. Well, and again, you know, the 9th is...
Because I have the due date here. Is this enough for
documentation? Yeah, well, should we get
written calendars are becoming the best alibi these days.
I keep these back since 2005 when I started.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I think we lost Paul briefly. Okay, well... That's great. I'll check back.
I got it.
Amenable to it.
Looks good.
Exactly. Okay. So let's think that's likely to happen. I need to confirm still.
I'll change it on my calendar right now.
And then use that as evidence for why I agreed to it previously. Yeah, yes. Hey, Paul.
Oh, it's so
I'm sorry, say that again?
Right?
It's
January.
I could do either day.
Great. Okay. I think everybody present and on the phone then can do the 9th. So let's I dare say Don will not hold this up, and Helder, I would be very surprised if he held that up too. So let's go ahead and plan on the 9th. I will need to confirm availability here, but I think we can do that. All right. Great. I think that's it for all of these announcements. Thank you for your patience. If you know, I put on the agenda again just to give an option. Were there anything more on the written comments to failure to disperse in writing? If not, we'll move on to the new package of sex offenses. I think, you know, we talked a good bit around the underlying disorderly conduct and other matters, and so there's nothing we really wanted to raise. You know, thank you for your written comments, and we might follow up again with folks on some of their some of the comments, but otherwise we move forward to sex offenses if there's no objection. Great. Okay, well then end us on sex offenses, and again, I know Dave doesn't have too long, so maybe I'd even kind of give Dave kind of first dibs on any questions to on the materials.
I don't have questions per se. I don't mind us going in the way we normally do, where you guys do the presentation, and as we go, I'll ask questions. If I'm not here or you get a point, we'll go over it privately separately.
Okay. Nothing in particular.
There's nothing that sort of taken out of context.
Sure.
That was going to make sense, especially considering until I hear from you. Maybe I misunderstood
something. You bet.
I seem to have sent an invitation to people.
Yes, I was just.
I didn't mean to. I thought I was just doing it on my own. Well, apparently it's happening on the 9th. I was just putting it because I just was putting it in my calendar, but it filled it on. I didn't think I had that kind of power. Holy shit.
Yeah, what else did you send up?
I'm kidding, for the record.
There aren't any pictures. Exactly.
And she wouldn't have shown it to me in any event.
Okay, I know. The three of us do revenge.
Anyway, Don has accepted on the 9th.
Great, Don's already accepted too.
That's how I know it happened.
Wow.
So,
all right. All right. Let me ask this then, because I think, you know, we, you know, on sex assault and on these other charges, frankly, you know, we could say a bit in terms of like overview, but you know, there's both, you know, a lot of detail in these statutes. And in some sense, not a whole lot of change either. Failure to arrest, obviously a big change, though. That one's in there, I don't know if you saw, which is, you know, that we're basically recommending the repeal of. So, yeah, I kind of want to shift it back to you all to see if you have questions based on your reading so far. You know, again, if not, we can say a little bit about the general structure of some of these in the recommendations. But if folks aren't far enough along to have any specific questions, you know, we can highlight a few things maybe. But like, I'm not sure how productive.
I mean, I can go through it. Yeah, yeah. Page by page. So I don't know. You know, my first question or comment is on page 8 on the definition of coercion.
Okay.
And I was just wondering whether you guys considered embarrassment as a type of coercion in light of the council's maybe legislation on blackmail. It may fit in there for these types of offenses.
Sure. And, you know, so this is, put it up on the screen. Sorry, I'll blow it up a little bit. This is, so he's talking, tiny bit starts on page 7, but it's the definition of coercion, right? And actually, let me pull up
the...
Which
report is that?
This is of report 26, the sexual assault and related provisions. Let me pull it up in the, so it's a little bit more condensed and on the screen. There we go. It's a little bit easier to see this way. Right. So, in part of the new structure, and then also I'll say a little bit, and then you know Rachel's our kind of expert on this, is you know the current sex abuse core offenses, right, are divided by the types of threats, or at least appear to be intended to grade differently. First and second degree sexual abuse based on the severity of the threat, with first degree being threats of, death, serious bodily injury, bad stuff, or really bad stuff, compared to second degree abuse, which is other threats. And it is literally, I can get the language here, but it, you know, the phrasing is poor, it can be a bit confusing. Just a second, I'll pull up the current language here. Yeah, so current second degree is by threatening or placing that other person in reasonable fear, parenthesis, other than by threatening or placing that other person in reasonable fear that any person will be subjected to death, bodily injury, or kidnapping. Okay? So again, like the basic structure of the current first and second degree is to grade differently depending on the nature of the threat. Now, one of the things, and I, you know, we talked about this a bit before, and I you know, it comes through in the material somewhat, is, you know, a big problem with the current statute is that the definition of force in the current statutory scheme kind of blows apart this, what otherwise seems to be the distinction between first and second degree. Kind of these threats of serious bodily injury, death, kidnapping, and then everything else. The problem is, first degree also says, you know, it says sexual act by using force, where force is a defined term that includes, and I quote, the use or threatened use of a weapon, the use of such physical strength or violence as is sufficient to overcome, restrain, or injure a person, or the use of a threat of harm sufficient to coerce or compel submission by the victim. And that last piece kind of swallows, it's the extent, you know, force, went to the extent that force means any threat of harm sufficient to coerce or compel submission by the victim. Now, that seems to wash out the distinction that was seemed to have been meant otherwise to distinguish between first and second degree liability for threats of these different types. So this is like the fundamental problem, and it appears to be not discussed directly in the legislative history. We, you know, was this a last minute change? We didn't, you know, all of this came out of the 90s, right? This kind of core structure, the update, which was, you know, in many ways, one of the best updates to the code. Go on record saying that. You know, right? It really did a lot to, from where things were, in a good way, and it was very progressive for that time. This is one aspect where somehow the final legislation seems to have this illogical kind of difference. And so, on that point, what we propose in the recommendations is that the new second degree, the equivalent of the new second degree, be just by coercion, okay? So this is the drop-down version. What you see here, this definition of coercion. In sex assault, the biggest way it applies is it is, I'll scroll down a bit, so you can see that the proposed second degree, it's, you know, an actor commits the offense of the second degree of sexual assault when that actor knowingly causes a person to engage in or submit to a sexual act in one of the ways, and the main one is, boom, by coercion. So this is supposed to map onto, again, the current breadth of the second abuse of threats other than by force, etc. Now, of course, this isn't exclusive. It doesn't say coercion other than threats of. And we think that's fine, right? In fact, it's in some ways desirable. If you're not sure about the nature of the threat, you know, this second degree will then kind of be a lesser included. up here in first degree, we still maintain the, the kidnapping, threats to kill, or commit an unwanted sexual act to cause significant bodily injury to another person, okay? So we've tried to kind of preserve the distinction in the offenses that we saw in current first and second degree. But it does change because, like, again, the current definition of force, we have this mismatch. So functionally, this is all by way of background, so what does this coercion definition do? What it really does is it tracks this the current second degree language and opens it up. And this bottom catch-all, so this is this definition of coercion, it tracks, things that we've done elsewhere. And we believe, now that we've gone through most all offenses against persons and property offenses, we can have this kind of a single definition, although, again, the A version, talks a bit about, it's these kinds of offenses. Maybe as we go on, we discover something that requires us to change the A. I don't know. Some of this is less, just going to be less relevant in a coercion used to gain sex situation. But bottom line, that G is the catch-all. And it's a flexible standard that reflects, we think, current law. So that's, and I think that would include potentially embarrassment.
You've also got C, which has hatred, contempt, or ridicule.
But that's what that's actually where I thought embarrassment went. Right,
right, but embarrassment is less. If we these are supposed to be serious, because second degree is a serious crime,
absolutely,
then embarrassment.
Well,
then it's all of middle school is embarrassing.
But it subjects it because you are subjected to ridicule, right?
Right. So that seems to me right. Exactly. It just seems like a more acute form of embarrassment, and I think that's appropriate.
Yeah.
So one of the reasons in the recent sexual blackmail statute that we just moved out of committee, we included embarrassment in that language and in a similar prong related to the distribution of images and audio recordings that might also tend to subject that person to hatred, contempt, or ridicule. So the that person part is the reason why embarrassment may be helpful is because that person is a objective statement, as in whether or not it would subject that specific individual to hatred, contempt, or ridicule, which means that any prejudices or biases against that victim get imported into the language of that statute. So in the case of, for example, prostitutes or sex workers, threatening to disclose their occupation or distribute images that were taken of them might not, as a matter of fact, subject them to hatred, contempt, or ridicule because of existing prejudices against that profession, but it may nevertheless subject that person to embarrassment. And it was contemplating those non-perfect victims, as sort of the literature describes them.
Under that analysis, or with that explanation, I think like where that would fit in this language would again be the G, right?
Okay.
So right, C. This is kind of the traditional, and I think partly where the recent bill departed and kind of extended, right, and made clear that again, it's not just this objective reputation. It also includes, like you're saying, for a prostitute who maybe their objective external reputation isn't tarnished by this because of the whatever other prejudice, but it is still intensely embarrassing and therefore in this case also compelling. One thing we could do, for instance, this obviously the bill came out after we kind of put this together. We can relook at this language for one.
That's why.
But secondly, I I'm not sure, it might not require a change to the statutory language. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. But again, the G is really a powerful and flexible thing, right? It's meant to, again, map onto the current language of, again, second degree sexual abuse. By threatening or placing that other person in reasonable fear, parenthesis, other than by...
Hey, I'm concerned.
Yeah, yeah.
This is law. I'm concerned about the expansion of liability here. So let's say that we have a man who says to another man, if you don't have sex with me, again, I'm going to tell everybody in your family that you're gay. Who don't know that you're gay. Should that be a crime? Should that be a sexual crime, you think?
I do.
Would it be under this embarrassment standard?
Well, I think even independent of the embarrassment standard, I think under subsection C, subsection G, depending on maybe that person's family doesn't like gay people or something, and under C, that would be definitely hatred, contempt, or ridicule, or possibly under subsection G. I think my concern with, and we can look at it again, my concern with adding an embarrassment would be it just doesn't seem quite as defined as ridicule, hatred, or contempt. But given the current language in second degree, by threatening or placing that other person in reasonable fear, other than these specified threats, I think if something is sufficiently embarrassing or awful to make someone engage in a sexual act or sexual contact that they otherwise would not do, I think that is warranted for second degree and fourth degree, but I don't think adding embarrassment helps that. I think it might water down the distinction just a little bit. We could also, look at it again depending on the legislation.
The other thing is, for G, and maybe I'm misremembering the commentary, but I took harm to actually mean a physical harm. Was it clear in harm? Because now we're saying G is a sort of a
reputational
general cap. Is it clear in the commentary that harm includes reputational harm?
I don't know if we'd have to double check that. We did not mean it to be limited that way. We would have used like bodily injury or something
harm. I don't recall it that way.
So clarifying that would be helpful.
When I made that note, I wanted to make sure that the issues that were addressed at that hearing were
right in this
were
catch-up.
Not lost in the statute. Whether we add the word embarrassment, which was my recommendation, or whether it somehow otherwise is included, I just want to make sure we don't. The council has passed legislation this year that we repeal next year because of a change in the definitions.
Yep, Paul.
Well, this is Paul. I think blackmail is a very different crime from a sexual assault crime. Right. So I wouldn't look towards importing standards in a blackmail crime definition to a rape crime definition.
And but that's not actually where I was going with it, just for one second. The testimony from people sitting next to me was that it was already covered by the existing statute, right?
Yeah.
Which is the sexual aspect of it was already covered by the code.
Yeah.
And if that is the case, then it is already the law, and the intent here is to keep it, I just want to make sure that it's clear.
We don't inadvertently write narrow it. So great, I think that is right as insofar as we want to make sure that again, let me back up. Our intent was that, again, this be basically the same in scope as the current second degree abuse, as we understand it. Now, Paul, I wanted to follow up with you, though. Your concern was that you think this still might be, this is too broad. Whether or not it tracks current law, you would be concerned as a policy matter that it is too broad to allow this kind of flexible threats of harm. Okay. Well,
that's my concern. As you probably know, with the model penal code revision of the sexual assault standard, this has been very controversial. The kind of force that, even if you grade it down to a second or degree or a misdemeanor, economic coercion, emotional coercion, financial, all of that.
Yeah.
I think we have to proceed very cautiously here. And again, even the model penal code hasn't gone to ridicule or embarrassment standard, and it's been pretty controversially so, but it started out pretty permissive in terms of expanding liability.
Yeah.
But I'd be really concerned about ridicule. Again, I think that's kind of incoherent, but it could lead to some really bad consequences.
Yeah. So make a couple points on that. I think one, absolutely, I've actually been able to sit in on the ALI kind of meetings on this as an outside person, and they had one recently, and again, this came up at discussion there, and it definitely is controversial, and it's controversial not only about the kind of the breadth of what coercion should be valid, right? Is it this kind of expansive? Should it be a narrower set? And it's not only not only as to the penalty that might fall from that, but it's controversial about the mental state. And one thing I want to flag here, and it may assuage some of your concerns, Paul, or maybe not, is again, we have a knowingly mental state applying here, and that also, as the commentary explains, reaches the fact that it was the core that the that's what caused the person to engage in sex acts. So let me scroll down to, again, for instance, we go to the second degree. When it says, you know, in our recommendation, an actor commits the offense of second degree sexual assault when that actor, one, knowingly causes the complainant to engage in or submit to a sexual act, two, in one or more of the following ways, A, by coercion, or B, these kinds of, you know, unconscious, finding a person conscious or otherwise incapable. As the commentary spells out, you not only have to kind of knowingly engage in a sexual act, which, you know, but also to know that the complainant did it and was caused to or submitted to it by coercion. So, which is to say, look, in most, I can share kind of the latest, model penal code, ALI working on this. You know, again, most cases, this is never, the mental state's never an issue, right? Like, you know, it's purpose. The person's, you know, it's pretty clear. But at times where the threat that's issued is maybe more implicit, right? And it hits more of these like factors that might be very specific, right? Like, I'm going to tell your parents, you know, that I saw you at the gay bar, right? You know, so okay, well, you know, it's less direct, but it may very well be that that kind of threat, the actor knows. The standard here is going to be that threat is what compelled that person to submit, the complainant to submit, but the actor knew that, right? Like, so the more.
Yeah, so again, yeah. For me, Richard, the concern isn't mens rea. You know, even if they're upping the standard from the reckless standard that's now part of the model of sexual assault.
Yeah.
Again, I get. Let's imagine a man who says to a woman, if you don't have sex with me, I'm going to tell everybody that we had sex the first time you met, and that's going to, you know, embarrass you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that guy is a cad. I'm not sure I want to describe him as a rapist. Mm-hmm.
What do you think that conduct maps onto in terms of an offense?
You know, what the model penal code says now is... they have their second degree kind of like thing is gross sexual imposition, and their standard is what anything that would prevent resistance by a woman of ordinary resolution. So, you know, describing the gendered language, you know, basically it leaves it to the jury to decide in a specific case whether the kind of coercion should count as sexual assault. To the extent that we're kind of doing that in a normative way now and saying that if ridicule, again, I'm just really concerned about that.
But, yeah. But also, the hypo, it's not clear that hypo would constitute sexual assault under this offense, right? Because you have to either meet sort of what traditionally amounts to blackmail, or if it's under the catch-all, it's the kind of threat that would cause a reasonable person under circumstances to comply. And so merely threatening to say that if you don't have sex with me, I'll tell people that, you know, you had sex with me on the first date, it's not clear that necessarily satisfies the elements of coercion.
It still leaves it as a jury.
Why not if it would expose the person to ridicule?
Yeah, I think you definitely would have a case for it. I think Janu's just saying, you know, depending on the particular facts, you know, it's not a sure.
Right, right. I mean, the blackmail standard isn't just sort of, you know, any degree of ridicule. You know, it's intended to be sort of a relatively higher. And it's not always, obviously, it's not a sort of a clear threshold. So you're going to have difficult cases like this. But
I know the ALI is still very much under a work in progress, but several jurisdictions do have something similar to this. I don't think I included in the National Legal Trends write-up how they were graded, but there are several revised or reformed jurisdictions that have very broad, by any threat, by coercion, by circumstances reasonably calculated to cause submission. So the ALI might be, I haven't looked to compare the ALI to those states, but the idea of rape or sexual assault being more than just a physical violent act, but an intrusion on autonomy, is kind of where sex assault is going. So to not have a provision like this at all, I guess grading is one question, but to not have a provision like this at all would change current district law, I think, make us more of an outlier. And like Kevin said, what would that be? Because if you do see sexual assault and rape as an offense, it's not just forceful violence, but an intrusion on sexual autonomy, well then you got to have something for that if you want to continue to broaden, as modern codes do, the idea of rape.
So, and like...
Well, first of all, I don't think it's certainly not the majority rule. I think, you know, that now there's a kind of emerging tension that's very much reflected in the ALI debates about the sexual assault statute between concerns about over-criminalization and expanding liability, and frankly, the kind of people who would be charged with these crimes would be mainly low-income Black and Latino people. So there's tension between that and doing the good work that we hope that sexual assault laws are doing, which is including protecting people's sexual autonomy. So I don't think we should overstate the case to make it sound like,
right,
you know, there's a rush to include other kinds of force or coercion in the definitions of sexual assault. And in fact, the ALI, which again we typically look to as our model, although we don't have to follow it, you know, in most cases it's pushed back. So if you look at the way that the original proposal defined consent to require affirmative consent, that was overwhelmingly rejected by the ALI.
Yeah, and just so I think Paul's kind of more up to date on this, but just bring the rest of you kind of, so again, a little background. A number of years ago, maybe 5 years ago now, 4 or 5 years ago now, the ALI decided to try to update just the sexual assault provisions that it had put out back in 1962, right? There's gendered language, you know, Paul mentioned in the part. There's also, you know, I think everybody agreed it was outdated and needed to be changed. But much as with the work we do, it's one thing to agree that things are problematic. It's another thing to put together the solution. So about 5 years ago, they started work on this. Two reporters, the ALI kind of structure, they have reporters, and they work with like a subset within the ALI being, you know, this body that's mainly law professors, the, you know, kind of leaders from the judiciary, a number of practitioners too, though. The reporters, who, by the way, include a PDS alumna, Aaron Murphy, and Stephen Schulhofer, who's the professor at NYU, who's the lead reporter, they've been directing this group, and they've put together recommendations that, frankly, you know, are moving slowly. I can send out, but basically to date, the only thing that's kind of gotten through out of all of there, in a little perspective, hope the council hears this, in 5 years worth of work, they have a couple of definitions put together, and they have drafts for a bunch of other, but it has been, as Paul was saying, very controversial. Even the one definition that they have about like sexual act and consent and sexual contact, the consent definition was heavily debated, and eventually very kind of overturned from where the kind of the reporters and its kind of immediate kind of advisory group had been going. Now, So again, we have this work. I'm happy to share kind of some of their latest. It's helpful to some degree because they too are looking at other jurisdictions, right? So they're trying to do some of this survey work that helps us. But you know, for instance, on mental state issues, which is a big thing for us, right? The current district laws are pretty, you know, pretty well structured, but they lack crucial mental state decisions. And you know, one thing the ALI really highlights is so do a lot of other jurisdictions. So anyway, by way of background, the ALI has been working on this. I can share where they are. They right now are pitching. It hasn't worked its way through and definitely is not approved by the ALI. Kind of two levels of they have what they are would right now call a sexual assault by exploitation or by extortion statute that they would say is a 10-year statute that is, again, kind of equivalent to the coercion thing we're talking about. It says, they would say, this is again a draft, an actor is guilty of sexual assault by extortion if the actor causes another person to engage in or submit to an act of sexual penetration or oral sex. They're a little bit more spelled out than we do, although it's substantively the same, and knows there is a substantial risk that the other person engaged in or submitted to the act because the actor explicitly or implicitly threatened, and then it has a list of things like to accuse that other person of a criminal offense or immigration violation, take or withhold action as an official, or C, anything that would cause submission to or engagement in such act by an individual of ordinary resolution in that person's situation under all the circumstances as that person believes them to be. So again, basically kind of getting at the catch-all that we have here, which I think, again, the catch-all that we have kind of maps onto current district law. Now, they grade it differently here in the new ALI, and the new ALI is just a draft. And I think Paul's absolutely right to say this is controversial stuff. It's hitting a lot of bumps as they've tried to roll this out because they're really conflicting sentiments. District law, though, is very much on the progressive end of this. We were in the 90s, depending on how you define progressive.
Exactly. That's a key distinction. Yes. What progressive means.
That's right.
Laura made a face
for you since you couldn't through the
phone. Thank you, Laura.
you need her to make any more faces. She'll make extra ones for you. She'll just spontaneously do that. The 90s when this came out was adopted by the district. Since then, again, this is the kind of the direction things have gone in other jurisdictions. Again, the ALI, what it's proposing, the gradations are a little different, the mental states are a little different. They actually go a little bit lower on one of the mental states than we would, going to recklessly instead of knowingly. But largely, this is the direction things have been going with. So, I think this is a policy difference, right? Like this is, and it may also be, I don't mean to say it distills down to this, but you know, a grading difference, right? Like in the background is how serious a felony is this, right? One thing I'd emphasize is that, and those of you who had a chance to look through the materials, right? So the setup of the revised version that we've done has sexual assault degrees that kind of map onto the current sexual abuse degrees in district law. And then it has a non-consensual sexual acts, which is here at the end of the recommendations, and it divides it into two degrees, one for an act, one for the sexual conduct. That largely maps onto the current misdemeanor sexual abuse, right? Which is kind of this catch-all at the bottom where, and again, we use we're proposing basically recklessly engage in a sexual act without effective consent. And so that gives some grading differences. When you look at what we're proposing, that would encompass just like the current misdemeanor sexual abuse offense in the district would encompass any kind of threats that, again, cause the person to engage in the sexual conduct. But it does so at a lower degree, right? It's a misdemeanor. It's 180 days. It's, non-jury demandable. We haven't gotten to penalties, how that'll figure in yet, but I just kind of put, like, the way threats figure into the framework in current law, it's at these two levels. A higher felony level for second degree for a sexual act by coercive threats. A low felony for sexual contact, not penetration or oral sex. Low felony. And then a misdemeanor as kind of a catch-all with a lower mental state. We have what we've pitched is largely tracks that with, again, serious felony for a sexual act by coercion with this definition, which we think maps on, a less serious felony for contact, again, with the same type of coercion, or this non-consensual sexual conduct, whether it's act or contact, will be somewhere below, the corresponding act conduct. So we have some grading distinctions that may help alleviate some of the different intuitions or filter out some of the different intuitions about the seriousness of this. But that's just,
for me, so with the model penal code, forcible compulsion is the most serious kind of rape. And then the proposal, there'd be another crime called basically non-consensual sex.
Yeah.
But it seems to be non-consensual sex. Oh. When there's no forcible compulsion per se, but there's not consent.
Yeah.
That would be a separate lower graded crime.
Yeah.
But it seems to me the conversation we're having is partly about what force means. And so, I think we're thinking about whether force, in terms of the most serious kind of sexual assault, should include non-physical force, and whether should include ridicule. I get that that the grading issue is different with the model penal code, but I'm not sure that we're still not focused on, the most serious kind of sexual assault.
Yeah, and that's a fair critique. That's a fair critique.
If you struck coercion, just that prong, it would end up knocking the situations we're talking about would be captured by the non-consensual sexual conduct.
That's right.
So that's kind of like a separate grading discussion that could be had.
That's right. And same thing as compared to current district law, if you struck from second degree sexual abuse, the threats, this kind of like other effective threats prong, what you would be left with for second degree sexual abuse and in our revised assault is that, basically an unconscious victim, right? That's the main other part of the second degree offense. When the complainant is asleep, unconscious, or passing in and out of consciousness, mentally or physically incapable of appraising the nature of the conduct, or mentally or physically incapable of communicating unwillingness. So these largely kind of map what, and hopefully clarify a bit what's in there now on those distinctions. But I get, Paul's basic point is, a policy difference as to, is this rape, right? And I want to, one thing this points to, perhaps, is the labeling, right? And, we've talked at times, the labels matter to some degree for some offenses. Maybe this is one where it really does. I don't know. The ramifications, we've gone, our suggestion is to move from sexual abuse label to sexual assault. And then again, from the generic misdemeanor sexual abuse to non-consensual sexual act or sexual conduct or contact. What are the collateral consequences? The other implications? All of these, you know, we haven't addressed this specifically under current law. Any offense in Chapter 30, these sex offenses, is eligible for sex offense registry. There's also flexible definition in current district law for sex offense registry. You know, that potentially scoops in any, you know, like you know, blackmail, right? You know, any other offense that is of a sexual nature, you know, potentially even, you know, some assault type thing. You know, our sex offense registry requirement both has some hard things that are specified and then a flexible definition. So I think all this stuff would presumably, unless we really changed that on sex offense registry, you know, would kick in for all of these offenses. Beyond that, you know, I don't know what to say about kind of the import of the label. Other thoughts or questions on this kind of train, or you know, again, it's very understandable. We've seen this in other jurisdictions, that there are basic, or in these ALI discussions about other jurisdictions and with many stakeholders, there are very different intuitions about like the level of seriousness of this kind of conduct. And current district law and what we're recommending departs from a lot of the historic standards that you saw reflected in the Model Penal Code as it now exists, and in other jurisdictions where physical force was kind of the main standard by which one judged rape. So this departs from that.
Really quickly, because I think it's non-controversial compared to what we've been talking about.
Yeah.
We have in the blackmail statute a caveat that the fact can be true or false, so that falsity is not a defense to 3C.
Gotcha.
I think there's,
That was a good addition, did you there, Kevin? That we might consider bringing over?
Well, I included it in some of my drafts, so right.
That's fair. Appreciate that.
I think some of our commentaries touch on that issue. It's not the statute, but
I thought one of them, I thought there was something that said, regardless of whether it's true or false.
Maybe in the
comment. Different offense?
Yes. Coercion arises in another.
Well, it's current. Yeah. It was current language in the blackmail statute. That was referenced.
And we can definitely revisit that, because I think we don't, at least, you know, again, the functional definition, whether it's true or false, like the experience of the person, right, you know, in terms of whether it is compelling or not, right, and it may be more, you know, if it's the, you know, it's the deep fake, you know, photo that's, you know, that could be tremendously, you know, coercive. In effect.
What about adding the controlled substances? I mean, that seems also like an expansion, and you have the word limit, and then that limit does not mean facilitate, but there is, it seems like there's a real potential of working in sexual transactions that are that are transactional, where drugs are changing hands for sex, and where you're not looking at force, but the circumstances are coercive, and the circumstances of addiction are coercive.
That's right, and that's a fair point. And these are very. We tried in the commentary to kind of, you know, get at this. We've tried to construct this coercion definition so it will apply across offenses, because psychologically, while again, you know, a fact finder is going to have to evaluate in each case, well, this particular, you know, denying drugs from, you know, the normal provider, is that okay? Do I believe that that, you know, was sufficient to cause you to, you know, have sex? Versus do I believe it was sufficient to cause you to give me $1,000 versus, you know, like, depending on what's going on, which particular offense you apply this, you might have very different intuitions, and the fact finder is going to have to weigh those. But for all of them, right, we intended this to apply, and so it'll, you know, the same issue comes up for property offenses, right? Like, you know, to the extent that, you know, this is used for coercion and property offenses. We want to omit pure transaction, right? You know, there might be liability for, you know, prostitution if you're exchanging, you know, sex for drugs. But that's not, you know, we don't want that to be sexual assault. Unless there's some other, you know, something that's going on where it's, again, limiting in a, you know, certain ways.
I mean, it's true, the language doesn't specify that the person needs to be actually addicted. So it doesn't, but that was the intent, was sort of as your point. We don't want the sort of transactions to be covered by this.
But transactions for drugs and sex, I don't think, I would bet they rarely happen in a non-addiction context. So if you have,
right.
What's the difference between limit and provide in exchange for, right? Like you can't have A unless you do B versus I'll give you B if you do A.
Yeah. And I, you know, it's, you know, we can and should, you know, check our commentary. I agree. I don't know that, like, addiction alone, like, you know, is going to, like, that's not going to be helpful in distinguishing these situations.
So what's the situation you're imagining that is not what Katja is saying?
Right.
Or it should be.
Right.
Whatever. Sexual assault.
I was thinking of, like, a nursing home abuse where it's, I'm not going to provide certain medications that you're mm-hmm. supposed to provide you unless, mm-hmm. you know, I've provided in person sex acts of some kind. Mm-hmm.
So restricting access to prescription to other
right. And the key is the options, right? The thought is, you know, your normal supplier saying no, I'm not going to sell to you unless you do X, right? You know, perform the sex act. Is that limiting the person's access? We don't mean to say that kind of denial, when the person could go, you know, three blocks over, and, you know, buy for money and not for sex. You know, that's the distinction. Whereas somebody in a nursing home or in a controlled situation who has no other options is essentially, like, you know, in an inherently, you know.
Wait. So yeah. What's the crime? I mean, what's the government proving? They're proving there was not a larger market in your area, and they're like, really, what's the scenario?
Did it in fact?
That's not the nursing home. That's about. That's not prescription medication, but that's, you know, heroin.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, you know, where this comes up, we saw a lot of this talked about, is in the trafficking context, right? So you've got somebody who, in addition to, is being essentially...
Right, but that's probably a person who's also somewhat kidnapped, right? Restrained.
Absolutely.
Potentially. So
absolutely.
We're not that.
Well, we are. We are. I mean, you know...
Well, we got trafficking for that.
Well, but this could be on top of trafficking. I mean, the fact that somebody's being held for, you know...
Right, but you could write that in. Then we could write that in.
As a restriction.
I mean, that could be what it means. I mean, the reason their access is restricted mm-hmm. is because they are in some other way restricted.
Yeah.
That they can't go shopping.
Yeah.
But so either that's a piece of this... Or there's some freestanding that's not a piece, and it's...
I mean, unlawful, one question. So, like, you know, for example, we used to have inflict wrongful economic injury. They were trying to distinguish, presumably, between some economic injuries and others. The question whether unlawfully restricting would be a modification, because it does seem weird in the situation... Well, no, because in the nursing home example, where it seems a bit clear that there's a problem, the presumably... the nursing home provider has some sort of obligation to provide the drugs. And so that seems materially different than the situation of a drug dealer who is saying, I'm not going to give you heroin or whatever if you don't have sex. Those seem, and it, so
yeah.
The lawfulness of the declination to provide the thing seems at least relevant. Like a one way of distinguishing.
So, well, one thing, just to sort of unpack, I don't remember what the comment says. I assume restricting a person's access to prescription medication means medication prescribed for that person, not
telling them no at the pharmacy.
Not OxyContin.
Right, yeah, exactly. Not something that someone might be prescribed, but it's not for me.
Right.
We do it. Right. Is that clear? Okay, well, I should write that down.
No, and I mean, you know, right, the analysis, you know, one of the fundamental questions here is, right, you know, kind of how this matches up with, you know, what else you've got in this second degree box. You know, a person who's unconscious, a person who is, you know, some of the other categories you know, mentally or physically incapable of appraising the nature of it, incapable of communicating unwillingness. And, you know, I think the question is really, like, was the, you know, you go to your, whoever the supplier is, and they demand sex or a sexual act in return for, you know, giving drugs. Is that coercive, right?
No.
And so...
It costs $1,000.
So let me say this. Would you agree that there are some such circumstances such that maybe your proposal would be that this isn't a kind of a per se coercion, but it would slip down to the definition, you know, the catch-all, and you'd have to analyze this, well,
no,
was this enough to compel the person?
That's what it, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's addiction.
Yeah.
But I do think it's important. Like, yeah. I get it in the trafficking yeah. context, but that's, or, yeah. you know, or in the
those are the easier cases.
Those
are the easier cases.
But that's not.
I agree. In the end, are this per, this just pushes the edge of, you know, is this person giving consent, right?
These
is this consensual sex?
Differentials.
Absolutely.
That you're always going to have. You could put in there an employee-employee relationship that there can be no that there can be no consent in that instance either with adults in an employer-employee relationship.
And again, it goes to, like, you know, and a threat by an employer to, you know, demote somebody or to pass them over for a raise, given in the particular circumstances. If that was, and again, you have to go to kind of, you know, compel a reasonable person, the same background, you know, to do this, that's a real question. And is somebody who is, you know, addiction is incredibly powerful. Do we want to treat sex and that exchange differently? Then and when that is happening, and when you know, you have to know, right, that this is what's causing somebody to do it. They, you know, we have the mental state. So what's causing the person to, you know, do this is their addiction and this transaction.
Yeah.
You
That's
know,
why they're willing to pay $1,000 because they really, really need it.
Yeah,
and they might say, you know, but down the block I can get it for $750. Well,
right.
Then go get it for $750.
Right.
But like, but well, if they can't go down the block to get it for $750, is it a crime to say it's $1,000? Now, granted, it's already a crime, right? So we've already got the issue with transaction, but you don't register as a sex offender because you are a drug dealer. But to say, like, look,
yeah.
Money's not really what I need today.
Yep.
But what would be great
yeah.
is a sex act.
Yeah.
Why is that rape as opposed to, like, this is a transaction? That's, you're right, it's prostitution.
Yeah. Yep.
That's
yep.
what that is.
No, I you know,
which some people think should be decriminalized.
Right. So we can Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a separate issue.
Well, I'm just saying, right? Like, if no, it is. Call it, a prostitution, then that's its own complicated thing.
I agree, but like it shows up the difference. Like, you know, again, the consent, what we might otherwise say is a consensual sexual act for money. You know, what the people's intuitions in terms of the policy here should be, but somebody who, you know, demands sex instead of money in that situation, is that coercive?
Or demands drugs?
So you're also like demoting the mental capacity of anybody who has a drug addiction problem. They can't make a rational decision to spend their time, money on rent.
No. I mean, it's the same thing for, again, the employee who makes the rational decision that, given the circumstances, I'm going to perform the sex that my boss demands because otherwise I'm going to lose my job and all the rent. You know, like, it's nothing to say that, you know, they aren't, that it's not possible, but that it is coercive in extent.
Yeah. Right? I mean, because someone might sort of say, like, I can get another job. Screw you. I've got valuable skills.
Yeah.
Or someone might say, you know that I have to have this job. Or, like, that $3 difference an hour is huge, you know, like... And so it strikes me that when you get to the mental states and stuff, that is going to be, that's closer to, I'm more comfortable with that with G. Because I maybe can't walk down the street and just pick up another job, mm-hmm. right? So I may be a little bit more trapped in this, in the same way that I am more comfortable with the limiting access to a controlled substance in the trafficking context, again, because there's another element to it, which is I can't go shopping around. There's some way in which... perhaps I am restrained.
So, Laura, getting back to Koch's comment earlier about challenges presented where you have power dynamic relationships, where do you guys come out where you have a 19 or 20-year-old intern, so they're the age of, they can consent, and there is a person who is a very powerful politician, let's just say. And so it's not that I'm going to lose this job, but it may... Maybe you can harm me, but you can also affect me in other ways. So that person now will register as a sex offender because that's a sex offense, or that's something different.
Right, and then you have other people determining whether it's coercive or not, where the complainant testifies, I decided to do this, I thought it'd be to my advantage, but I thought it would open doors for me, but, you know, we have a jury considering, you know what, that was really coercive, given the fact that individual is 19.
But if I don't have to threaten to
right.
inflict some, so it could be like you...
Why?
Well, just by coercion means threatening that any person... Creating any person doing the following combination. So it just can't be like, I think that this powerful boss
right.
maybe will promote me, therefore I have sex with that boss. The boss has to threaten something like,
cause
at the very least, like, he won't be promoted okay. even, or whatever.
So promises,
so it's negative.
Die
out. Well, it could be, right. I mean, right. These could be right, but.
Right, so presumably this wouldn't apply where, for example, the drug addict came and said, hey, I'd like to have sex with you if you give me the drugs for free, right? So in that situation, the drug dealer hasn't threatened to do this or else, but is rather being approached, like, or no, you know?
That's what we intend, but like,
wait,
again, how whether we...
So the person says, look, I'm out of cash, but I'm willing to sleep
yeah.
with you.
Right.
So that's
that
okay?
Not every agreement, like overt agreement, where I say I agree to engage in the conduct you've asked me to,
right.
is actually a product of a transaction. A transaction is a cost-benefit analysis, usually on economic lines, but I guess it could be reputational and things like that, as to what I like to engage or not engage in. And then we as a body, but then the council as its own legislature, says there are certain inputs into that transaction that are illicit because they have a capacity to completely destroy an individual agency in these contexts. Threats for in-person sex acts. Threats to report this person to law enforcement. So it's about
some of those are categorical. We just say, generally speaking, threats to beat someone up are usually not in a transactional context. Although, even that is prone to some transactions. Like, significant bodily injury is part and parcel of certain sporting events or things like that. So we've been able to say we can unpack situations where that harm is at play, but entered into willingly, and situations where we just feel, as a matter of human intuition and experience, it's overcoming someone's sort of default will. I can't really explain the phenomenology better than that.
But just, you still noted threats, though, right? Because, I mean, it seems like there's a difference to be made, right? So, again, between someone who says, I'm going to offer you sex to get this thing, right? Versus when the person with the thing says, have sex with me or else.
And I think, honestly, that the only difference may be the propositioner's intent. I don't know if there's really a better distinction than that.
What it sounds to me like the difference is the whether you guys think that the voluntariness of them offering the sex act instead is really voluntary, right? Is that, are they really able to consent to it? Is a person who's saying, hey, I'll do this in exchange for XYZ, different than a person who is so addicted that they really need it and they can't say no? And it really seems to me more about the quality of that person's ability to consent. It's almost like the discussion about the age for minors and that sort of thing in that respect, where we just have drawn these lines that say we don't care if the person wanted to do it or not. They're so overcome, they're so vulnerable in some sense, that we don't think that they're capable of consenting to that kind of an act. And I don't know that you can do that kind of line drawing in this way, but it sounds to me that that's where the line is on where everybody's intuitions are going with respect to the, like, blowjob for coke exchange kind of a scenario. Because no one would really have a problem with someone who's just walking around offering blowjobs in exchange for drugs. But everybody seems to have a problem with the idea of an addict being threatened with, you know, having to go through withdrawal if they didn't do it.
Right.
Well, I'm sorry. Now it's too informal.
So I'm trying to think in other situations where you have, and when I say overt agreement, I mean like one party says yes, another party says yes, but we have beneath the surface a feeling like it wasn't that simple.
Yeah.
So like you see this on the flip side, it's going to be in like self-incrimination cases or someone waived privilege overtly, but then upon a deeper examination of the issue, you say, no, that waiver wasn't actually voluntary because the cops were punching them below the table or things like that.
But how is this fundamentally different than sort of standard situations that arise in everyday life? For example, a person who's at poverty line takes a job like doing extremely low wage work that no one in their right mind
hazardous
would want. Right. Yes.
Right.
So what we normally do is we say there are categorically types of threats, where we say a threat to distribute images that have sexually explicit content.
Right.
As a matter of just human experience, are going to almost 99% of the time be illicit threats.
But we keep talking about threats. So I don't know if it's relevant, but we keep, because it does seem like the difference between a threat, right? Because you don't think of like an employer of a hazardous job being like, take this job or be poor. Exactly. But right, you know, but it seems like the threat piece of it is at least to some extent what differentiates.
Yeah, but what does that label of a threat really mean here?
Yeah, a threat is communicating a proposition with.
But even if it's a threat, someone makes a voluntary choice to make, it can still sound like an exchange. Like somebody could still, a boss could say to someone, if you don't do this, I'm going to fire you. And the person could still, in their mind, engage in the affair.
And Janu talked about what you're getting at, in my mind, in terms of things being implicit. And so sometimes it's easier to see the implicit threat. Person says to other person, you know what? I bet you wouldn't want other folks to know that we did it on the first date. Okay, but I think we all see that one. But in the example that I was given and others that people have thrown out, that implicitness is a little more, I mean, it's sort of in the eye of the beholder, and I guess...
Right, threat doesn't work as we're, because we're talking about whether it's coercive or not when we're talking about addiction and drugs, right? So it's any, you know, we're if we accept that sex can be transactional, whether it's legal or not, but if it is not, we're calling it prostitution, right? Then you know, so even your example of the, hey, I don't have any money, but I'll offer you a sex act. I don't know why that's okay, but the, look, you don't seem to have any money, and I don't give away drugs for free, but you know what I would take? Like, why is that awful? Why is it the fact that I said it first, me, the drug dealer, so much worse than the addict saying, hey, you know what I could exchange? Why is that?
I mean, you can imagine a fact pattern where it's so clear to the person who is saying, I don't need money today, I need this instead, where it's so obvious to them that the person that they're saying that to is in desperate need of what it is that they have, right?
But what if they can go down the street?
But what if they can't?
So I think, I mean,
right?
that's...
Like, when it's really obvious that this person is, like, I mean, they're jonesing.
So the price
in front
just...
of you,
okay.
Right?
And so normally it's $350, but you've pulled out a wad of cash. Actually, it's $500. Is that awful? Is that terrible? Is that a crime that I just put up the price? Because you were desperate for what I'm selling, and you clearly have the money. So now it's $500. Is that like, oh shit, that is the most awful thing that's ever happened? No, we're like, that's called capitalism.
Yeah, you know, look, I don't think anybody, you know, I pulled up the definition of blackmail that we have, right? The current one, not the latest and greatest, you know. but yeah, I mean, this is traditional, like, blackmail, extortion, you know, take, you know, sex aside, you know, this also happens for property, right? Where we say, like, sufficiently coercive. Now again, I'm giving you a choice. It particularly comes up with the, you know, the form of extortion where it's
right,
economic injury.
You're going to fail the quiz, right?
Right.
There was a threat of doing something.
Right.
Cuz there was an example, cuz I was looking at this recently.
That's right.
Oh.
One theme around this is, like, again, you know, like we talked about, it's a threat, right? It's conceived as a threat. And it's somehow, it's coercive, okay? It's not the normal kind of, like, barter. I'm changing this for, you know, offering this for this. And fine, even when we can eliminate some stuff by saying some things are categorically barred. You can't deal in transactions of this type, right? Like, we're just saying that. Maybe sex is one, but I think, you know, you have a valid counterpoint, which is, well, at least, you know, in some situations, and, you know, maybe that's a valid one. Okay, so if we can't categorically bar the type of thing being traded, what is it about the nature? And I think, again, you know, these are... The traditional way of kind of saying this is, wrong. You know, even here, it's reaching for the wrongful use of actual or threatened force or violence or economic, right? Like, it's stretching to what is the wrongful piece of that, and, you know, it can't just be the psychological state of the other person, because you may never know that, right? Like, the person, you know, may be hiding their addiction or how much they're compelled by what's going on. So mental states aren't totally going to solve this. But if somebody is engaging, if the seller, if the drug provider, if, you know, whoever, again, is being charged with this, if their intent was they're doing this knowing that it's, you know, then somehow it does seem to step out of the normal transactional realm.
Are we overthinking this? Do we just need to think about what it means to limit a person's access It doesn't mean refuse to sell, right? You know, like, here's the price. Right. Today it's a blowjob.
I mean, like, some of the cases that we would think of is, instead of just, like, right, like a sort of one-off transaction, it could be a case where someone sort of routinely obtains these substances from someone, doesn't know where else to get them, so the only source, I'm going to go through extreme withdrawal if I don't get whatever drug today. The person's like, I know that you're addicted. Here's the deal. You have to have sex with me or else. These cases where someone's truly sort of manipulating the person's addiction in order to get them to consent to this. And you can step back and say that this is just never, sort of that means of obtaining consent is just categorically never sexual assault. But which is why the limit's doing a lot of work.
I don't have to sell to you. I don't, you know, you're wearing a dark blue tie. I don't sell to people, you know, like, I can make up whatever.
It seems to me that in some cases, some of the hypos you've thrown out were, it's sometimes, I could see, to go to Patrice's point about the voluntariness, the presentation is very different. Like, if the would-be seller says, if you do not give me a sex act, I will not sell this to you, is a lot different than today is the price of a blowjob. I see them as being different somehow. And in the situation where it's more of an upfront statement or some casual conversation or the guy has no idea that the complainant, would-be complainant, is addicted, maybe the mental state would take care of it in some instances there because the defendant would never be practically certain that the complainant engaged or submitted to the sexual act because of this coercion. And in fact, I think there is room for an argument in some of these hypos that the complainant may not have engaged because of the coercion. You could have evidence that the person, you know, it was more of a conversational statement at the beginning. The complainant might have testimony saying that it was a good idea, it was a good deal, there was no one else around. I think that there is some room still, independent of the potential issues that the language in subsection F introduces, there still is room for fact-finding because the complainant actually has to engage or submit because of this coercion, or if it's coercion at all, and then there is that mental state component. So it seems like in some of these hypos, at least, there is room for the argument that it wasn't coercion, or it was coercion, but it didn't actually cause submission.
But does because of mean...
Hi everyone, this is Paul. Sorry to interrupt, but I have to sign off. So great conversation, important, and I will see everyone in December.
Thank you,
okay,
Paul.
Okay, thanks, Paul.
Bye-bye.
So does because of mean that it contributed to it, or that it's like a but-for kind of a cause? Because if I just keep thinking of the employer-employee context, and if the person says, hey, you know, one quick way to get promoted is to sleep with me, and the person thinks it over and says, yeah, I'm going to do that, in part because he promised me this thing, right? I don't know that it just contributing to it should be enough.
I don't think it should be either, but that really goes to a larger issue of causation across the board that we could talk about. That wouldn't be specific to just this, I don't think. But my initial thought would be, no, contributing should not be enough. It should be more of a, you're compelled to, a but-for cause. But that is something that would apply to all the offenses, and perhaps the commentary would have to flesh out after we discuss it further.
Further discussion around this at this point. Sorry, Dave, this is a long conversation that you missed.
I didn't expect another meeting. No. Time for me to come back.
Sure. And, you know, right, really talking again, particularly about this, the effect of a controlled substance and the prong we have on the definition of coercion. Mm-hmm. And, you know, questions primarily from Laura and Katya about, does this sweep in a way that we don't want, transactional exchange of sex for drugs? That seems to be like the main threat, right? Like, how do we even talk? Like, how do we conceptually and like in draft language, what could we do to separate that out? I think there's at least interest, perhaps more generally, in if we can find a way to do that, and again, kind of like explain that again, in some sense, where there's real, you know, effective consent. You know, again, you know, you find lots of words, but you know, how do we communicate that it was, you know, the person was truly able to say no and walk away, versus the person knew that they couldn't, and was capitalizing on that to extract sex. Like, you know, we've got these extremes, and like where we, how we articulate and draw a line there, tricky. And how, where current law is on this, I would say too, like, look, you know, I said it before, but you know, the current sex abuse language is just a threat, other, any threat, you know, kind of other than those few limited things which were put into first degree constitute second degree, is a threat, you know, in the transactional situation, you know, under current law, I don't know. We don't have a case on point. There was one, though, where it was like there was somebody, it was a prostitution case, and it was the question, but it kind of
fear
lines
of
up.
Arrest.
I'm sorry?
It was fear of arrest.
Oh, no, no, no. So there was that one. It was another one where it was like a guy offers, like, come back to my place and we'll smoke a joint. Does anybody, is this ringing a bell? So it was a misdemeanor prostitution case, DCCA, last 10, 15 years. And, right, the question, you know, like, okay, is this, are you offering something of value in exchange for sex, right? And it kind of opened up this can of worms, like, oh, well, what if I say, you know, let's go out for, you know, dinner tonight and I'll pay? Or, you know, like, where do you draw the line about this, right? You know, I don't know, maybe there's some language, we can poke a little bit more, but I think there's just no case law on this. That second degree current language is really broad, though. So, putting us, we can go outside the bounds of current law, you know, and make a policy change here. But I think it's also important to keep in mind that this type of conduct we're talking about may well also already be within the bounds of current law, because we have this broad second degree language.
So, Richard, does it make sense to? I mean, I guess the only line that I could see drawing is maybe, you know, the situation where a person is physically withdrawing, right, is a little different than others because there's this physical harm that might be inflicted as a result, as opposed to saying limiting their access to a controlled substance, saying something about, you know, that this is, that the person's doing it because they are trying to avoid a physical, not bodily injury. I don't remember if that would...
But it's a little bit weird to think of a drug dealer not providing a drug.
The omission. Failure to aid.
Exactly. Like, you know, I think one thing that's kind of unintuitive here is that it feels like we're talking about this idea that drug dealers have an obligation to sell their drugs for market value, and that's just weird to kind of say.
But that's why you have prescription medication in there, right? Like, it's the same idea. Here we have somebody who's in a position of power to give someone something that they need, whether it's a controlled substance or prescription medication.
Yeah, to give or to limit.
And it's like a threat of withholding something that they know the person needs to be well, as opposed to saying... Like,
well, and getting sex for it, too. That's the thing. You can always just say, I'm not going to sell it to you. It's the idea that you're getting sex for it. Like, mm-hmm. That's the...
Yep.
That's the...
If it was money alone, we wouldn't... Yeah. We, you know,
sorry,
we're in transaction land again for...
No, but it is... I mean, it's the physical part of it that I think is, yeah, is bothersome. If it's just somebody who's not withdrawing, I don't know why it's...
I mean, but part of the rationale is that, obviously, withdrawal is power, but just that addiction of itself can be extraordinarily powerful,
yeah,
as a motivating for people to consent to all kinds of things.
But unless you're willing to say that it's so powerful that we're going to categorically exclude people the way that we exclude people who are under age 16, I don't think that that's an appropriate line to draw. I mean, that's pretty paternalistic to say, okay, anybody who has a substance abuse problem is incapable of voluntarily transacting the way other people who engage in prostitution are able to. I think it has to be limited to the situation that's closest to someone withholding prescription medication, where it's like, you know that the person is doing this because without doing it, they are going to be physically unwell.
And so Laura's also right that, like, limit does a lot of work, which I would try to cut, facilitate, so that it's not intended to just capture sort of your ordinary sort of one-on-one transaction, that you're...
Real quickly, so the interesting part is that, G, you have this language about how the threat needs to be sufficiently powerful. Just a question of, like, so that means A through F, there's really no analysis on the severity of the threat,
that's right,
or like the vector.
That's right.
So I can, say, I can, yes, I can 3E threaten to inflict a $1 wrongful economic injury to you, and per the language of the statute, it's a categorically wrong offense. There's no analysis as to whether or not a $1 threat would actually, as a matter of fact, change my psychology in the transaction.
Well, so, and at least in the definition. Now, again, once we plug the definition in, and we have to say it did cause the person to engage in, and you knew that it was that the $1 thing was causing, like then that knocks it like out a lot of the ridiculousness. Once we take the definition and plug it into the offense, and then you know it actually has to be causal.
So
right, so the coercion here, whatever this is, it constitutes coercion with, you know, of any degree, as long as it's wrongful economic injury. And then whether in a particular case, is it causing the person to engage in and submit to, and did the person know that? You know, did the actor know that, you know, it was causal?
Simply because it's coercion does not mean it's going to be second
right,
degree.
Right, right. So it doesn't, assault. Like, it's... that isn't the end of the analysis. So you're right. Like it, at one stage, it's enough to say to get in one of these boxes. But again, then was it causal on top of that? You know. Now again, it doesn't. I don't think that second step plugging in for limiting access to a controlled substance. I'm not sure that takes care of. You know. The you know the transactional thing because yeah you know like your concern it sounds like well maybe I should ask this is your concern that a transaction should always be of for instance, you know sex for drugs should never be in here. Should never fall into second degree sexual abuse, or is it that there might be some circumstances, but it should be more limited than what's here? Kind of like you want to
We've
knock
got the
it
nursing
all out.
Home.
I'm sorry?
We've got the nursing home. I'm fine with that.
You're fine with the nursing home part, right? For
where there's the duty
where
to provide in that
and you're
duty,
truly restricting.
Right,
they don't have another option. Is
when
that the kind of like
right.
like if you
the option then becomes really broad. I think when there's a duty and you're conditioning your duty on the performance, you may be like stealing the drugs in the nursing home and then and that's one area
okay.
where there would be an option. But these
okay,
are,
yeah, I mean
these transactional situations
yeah,
where then you're when you're put in the position of grading the individual that you're having this transaction with. That doesn't
even in a case where you have some kind of indication of physical withdrawal or real addiction that the drug dealer is taking advantage of to obtain sex. Even that should be
So what about this? So right. So the other we talked about sort of physical restriction. I'm thinking about this of a person who is, an addict and is at least temporarily housebound, and says, I really need whatever heroin, cocaine, whatever. And the person says, I'll run out and get it for you, but the price of that is that, and if I don't, I don't. Is that
subtle limitation even.
Yeah, are you limit, like, and partly this goes to, again, like the giving, like, you know, the difference between giving,
so that's
failing to give and versus limiting when that kicks in. You know, we tried to make that distinction. The ALI language, by the way, this all is in kind of one of the permutations for the ALI, and you know we their language is give or sorry, let me pull it up because you know we tried to take a more restricted
crafting language
version
is just
of this,
facilitating or limiting.
But even
so
also
the other thing,
that
might not
limiting.
Be a threat
either.
I almost think
right,
that
is the most easiest transaction.
If we're really
yeah.
thinking about duty situations where
the
duty is contemplated,
really
you get rid of F and then you simply insert in D,
yeah.
take or withhold action.
What?
Something about like, well, hold on. That's not an official action. I mean, it could just be failing to perform a duty imposed by law.
Well, that's why unlawfully. But so if you just add the word unlawfully limiting someone's, right? So then you're, or even wrongfully. I mean, because look, I think there's a reason, I don't fully know why, but why the adjective wrongful is in the prong before it. I mean, because there's
the holder.
Right, but so, like, for example, the situation where you say, if you don't have sex with me, I'm going to go tell every drug dealer in Washington, D.C. not to sell you drugs. That, to me, seems less controversial as a means of, like, sex by coercion, as opposed to just, I'm not going to sell you my drugs unless.
The other thing, too, is, like, I'm thinking about a situation where we're writing laws and the design is that they're complied with. So in a world with universal compliance under the current proposal, what would be incentivizing is drug dealers to enter into those transactions and provide, like, emergency withdrawal services.
I think you'd be incentivizing don't extort sex for the provision.
Right.
Well, yeah. I mean, but essentially the way to cure that then would be to say, you're right, I can't do that. Now I just have to enter the transaction. If someone says, assuming full compliance with the law, I just want to think deeper about what is the system of transactions.
How is this
going
to, like,
create? Like, if someone has an expensive painting, and they say, you know, and there's someone who really wants that painting and says, well, you know, the only way we can get this painting is if you have sex with me. I don't think we would consider that.
Right,
that wouldn't be. So why is drugs
because
different?
Because addiction is so powerful. Like, no one, you know, painting is, you just want this painting. This is sort of a reflection that people's, almost like their free will to some degree is impaired. It can be to some degree impaired when you're addicted to various controlled substances.
Well, it seems to me that even PDS,
you'll take advantage of that. It's different than.
It seems to me that even in talking today, it seems like, and maybe we'll talk about this again in December, but it seems like we all can kind of agree there's some transactional stuff that should not be, because it's not coercive, even if you have an addiction, maybe. It's like a spectrum. But in an instance where you have a drug dealer who knows this person is shaking and having all these issues for withdrawal and chooses to, he or she can say, I'm not selling to you, and walk away. What this would be saying is he or she cannot say, give me sex or I won't give this to you. It seems like there's a narrow, even in a transactional setting, there is room for an argument. There's a narrow set of transactional circumstances where it's still sufficiently coercive. But there's also a lot where it's arguably not and probably shouldn't fall under this, maybe.
But what about a decent
proposal?
That person
says, okay, I can't sell to you because that would be a sex offense. So you go commit four prostitution acts and then bring me back the money from those four sex acts that you have to commit. Right? I mean, that's also...
That's also an offense, though, too.
But it's not rape.
It's not rape,
but interesting. I don't know. I think what's interesting
right,
is
like compelling.
Under the current law, we've never seen bleed over from sex offenses, sex abuse to prostitution. But if you take current second degree, fourth degree very seriously, that's broad. Then I think every time you make someone engage in prostitution, you are committing sexual abuse. And there is a big disconnect in how the district's prostitution laws they don't reflect that reality at all. But I think
it's
like
it's worth flagging
defense here.
It's worth like
square deal, fair deal.
I mean, no, but it's like, I don't know. Like, I mean, that seems to be what we're articulating, is that there are true transactions and there are not.
Yeah.
And
well,
I mean, like, if that's the
right
thread needle we want to thread,
that
then just make it
yeah.
explicit. Like,
yeah.
bona fide transactions are not. I don't know how you. What the flavor of transaction, how
yeah.
to describe it, should
yeah.
be. Bona fide seems a little too official, but...
Yeah, yeah.
I will say, just, and we're basically, we're even a couple minutes past noon, so we need to wrap up, or end. I want to close by flagging what Rachel just referenced, which was that, you know, both in the trafficking commentary and sex abuse, you know, we talk about some of these offenses, and we talk about the elimination, particularly in trafficking, of a number of usually not whole offenses in the prostitution chapter. Often it's pieces of it. But, you know, again, our trafficking regime was brought in. It kind of follows the model, right? And it was layered on top of a lot of offenses, prostitution-type offenses that involved... for sex, you know, compelling somebody to engage in sex for money. Now, apart from the general conceit, not reflected in law, that trafficking is somehow more of a repeat kind of situation, but that isn't what the law says. You know, it is forced prostitution, right? So pandering, a lot of what used to be these kinds of older prostitution type offenses, we're getting rid, we're proposing to get rid of aspects of some of them or many of them, and rely instead on the trafficking framework, which is kind of, it's just more coherent, more recent. And again, when that was introduced, they didn't go through the extra work of like, oh, okay, well, this basically takes care of, you know, this type of this prostitution offense. We want to clean up, there's a ton of prostitution-related statutes, and we want to make it clear, like, hey, if it's forced prostitution, meaning, you know, forced fraud, coercion, you know, is involved in compelling somebody to engage in a sex act, well, okay, that's trafficking. And, you know, a number of, a pimp, you know, it's a fine line, perhaps, between, again, engaging in a kind of transactional relationship and overseeing the transactions.
A business manager,
qua business manager, which is, or if there's coercion or fraud, and fraud is in a fair dealing even sense, right? This is actually kind of almost explicitly brought up in the trafficking statutes. You know, you're in trafficking land, and that pimp may very well, like, we often think, again, trafficking often isn't a label applied to like a street level pimp at a low level, but the difference between that, it is. I mean, so we're trying to like clean that up a bit, and so it's something else to just kind of flag as you look at. We don't think there's any loss in coverage, but it gets rid of some. Again, some of these old prostitution statutes are poorly drafted. You know, no doubt about that. But what's going to be left behind is still base prostitution, which is a live issue. People feel very differently. Exchange, you know, we've been kind of entertaining the idea, right, that exchanges of sex for money are acceptable. They're not, right? They're not under current law, right? That's prostitution, right? And, you know, it's a tremendous grading difference between, you know, but it's still illegal, at least right now. And, you know, it's a separate question. Should that be, what grading, et cetera? We'll get to that in the future. On that order of sequence of things,
with
prostitution
is
a
thing at the end.
Further off. What?
With body houses.
Body houses in there with the prostitution too. Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. Okay, thank you all. And, yep, happy to meet, follow up with anybody as needed.